Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
It's very difficult, I think, to live with not knowing, not being sure. It's difficult enough with things outside us, even things that don't have any direct relevance or impact on our lives. We like things to be clear-cut, sharp, have some definition to them. I think it's worth examining why we find ourselves reacting against or feeling uneasy or even threatened when things aren't clear. We don't have an easy answer or a quick label or explanation for things. Notice how easy it is to confuse descriptions with explanations. Sometimes we're just so hungry for the opportunity to put things away and not have to think about them anymore, that our hunger for some resolution and completion leads us to accept basically a description of something as an explanation. Don't like living with ambiguity. So the willingness to live with ambiguity and the development of the skill to be at home in ambiguity is something that Buddhist training can give us. The ability to refrain from coming to a conclusion. To be able to sit halfway up a ladder. To be present, to be at home in situations which you don't really understand. To be traveling in a foreign land which you are unfamiliar with only the most basic of maps, and yet to be able to enjoy the forests and the trees, the streams, and if one's really skilled, even to enjoy the experiences which are not immediately pleasurable. There's no way that you can ever have everything worked out. If you have got everything worked out, then look out, because you're heading straight for a fall. The only people who have everything worked out are what we call fundamentalists. And they live in a very bright, clearly illumined room without any doors or windows. It's like a room with a bright neon light in it, but there's no fresh air in it, and it's dead and sterile. Being present with ambiguity and uncertainty means that the doors are open, the windows are open. Maybe sometimes there's a draft. Maybe sometimes there are mosquitoes flying in on the draft. But it's alive and it's full of potential. And in contrast to most religious systems, which are belief systems, Buddhism is an education system. It is, in an essence, a system of education. It's the most complete form of education which has ever appeared in the world and ever will appear in the world, because it addresses every single aspect of our being. As a child, as an adolescent, when I started to question what's life all about, what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong, what's a good way to live, why is it that everyone, without exception, dislikes pain and seeks for pleasure and happiness? Why is it that after thousands and thousands of years, we're so inept at our most basic project as human beings? How is it that everyone in the world wishes to be happy, and yet so few people have ever studied the nature of happiness? Many of these kinds of thoughts came up in my mind, and looking back on it now, I see that I never considered these in any way religious questions. These were life questions, and religion meant believing in things, and I rejected believing in things as a strategy for dealing with discontent and unease and the basic existential questions that life threw up at me. So it was quite a revelation when I came across Buddhist teachings. You see, I wasn't being expected or bullied into believing things or made to feel bad if I couldn't believe things. I was encouraged to inquire. I'm encouraged to see that the faculty or the tool by which I could understand the nature of happiness or to realize happiness was severely impaired, lacking in quality, lacking in precision. It needed to be trained. It needed to be educated. Although Buddha Dhamma is sometimes compared to science, usually very favorably, it receives those sciences, is very prestigious. So in the Protestant Buddhism phase, it's a great deal of effort put into trying to promote Buddhism as being scientific, you know, scientific meaning good. But science is rather limited in that it lacks any clear understanding of the nature of the scientist, meaning the scientist's mind. And just assuming that anyone who has the correct technology and the instruments of measurement at their fingertips can understand. The Buddha said that only the mind which is free from hindrances can see clearly. So there are, before we can even begin our quest into the nature of existence, we need to very humbly work at the instrument which is going to do that work, which is the mind. As long as the mind is just dancing around or slipping and sliding around on the surface of things, can never really penetrate the truth of situations, the truth of life, in anything other than the most superficial, inconsistent way. So our work and our form of education is the education of the mind, and to provide it with the ability to dwell non-distracted in the present moment. Now, much of the so-called progress and technological prowess that human beings are so proud of has been devoted to development of distractions. Now we have the most complex, fascinating, superb kinds of distractions from the way things are. We have ways of forgetting ourselves that were not available to people of previous generations. We can pick up a telephone and gossip across continents. We can lie, cheat. We can fool. We can mock. We can deceive at the touch of a key. So our our methodologies have increased, but our goals remain depressingly the same. And there's very little questioning of what for. When this does happen every now and again, it's very refreshing. I remember reading some time ago about the debate in America over whether or not to build a supersonic airliner. The British and the French had built Concorde, and it was very prestigious. and the Americans were considering whether they should build one. And so the debate actually was quite an intelligent one. And a very important question came up is, well, what advantages would come from building a supersonic airliner, to make it worth the huge investments involved? And the answer was, well, it would cut time it takes to fly from Los Angeles to New York from 6 hours to 3. And they decided, well, maybe it wasn't worth the money. And then somebody said, well, suppose you were to cut flying time from 6 hours to 3. What would you do? What would most people do with the 3 hours that they saved? And the answer was probably watch television. So some genius came up with the idea of putting televisions on the planes. Which was far cheaper. You see, rather than spending all this money to fly for 3 hours and then watch TV for 3 hours, just fly for 6 hours and watch TV the whole way. It's kind of an intelligent, if somewhat worldly, way of dealing with problems. But we're not quite so logical as that. And the question of why and what for rarely comes up. I mean, the question is usually, well, we can do it, therefore we have to. If we don't do it, someone else will do it and get an advantage over us. So this is fear of losing out. And so that's a kind of primary engine behind much of the development. But in Buddha Dhamma, we have a goal. We have a focus. We have a goal of leading to wisdom, compassion, dispassion, cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. Remember, Rumpo Sumedho once telling us about a conference or a meeting he'd had with his psychiatrists and psychotherapists and people of that ilk in England once, and he asked them, "What is your idea of of perfection or completion? Your ideal human being?" And they were unable to answer this. And I asked this question recently of a large group of Christian priests and nuns, and they even found it difficult to come up with a clear answer. But in Buddhism, we have the Four Noble Truths, and somebody was telling me today that they've been taught about Buddhism in school in Texas. Buddhism teaches that life is an endless cycle of suffering and despair. And she said when all the students were told this was the essence of Buddhism, they said, how depressing, and wanted to go on to something else. But of course, that's only the first noble truth and not a very accurate representation of it either. And the Four Noble Truths are of illness, cause, cure, and medicine. So it's actually an optimistic, if you want to discuss it in terms of pessimism or optimism, then surely it would be an optimistic teaching in that it says there is a cure for the medicine, for the illness. There is a medicine. If it was just, we have this awful terminal illness and there's no cure for it, then it would be rather depressing teaching. But there is a cure. And the Eightfold Path is the cure. This is the Buddhist education system, which we call the Eightfold Path. And it has a goal. It's the goal of arahantship, the goal of enlightenment, and the goal of complete eradication of or absence of every trace of greed, hatred, delusion, a mind which is full of wisdom, compassion, purity, freedom. It's only the mind which has followed this Buddhist education system that can even have an inkling of what the word freedom means. So the Buddhist path is scientific in a certain sense, but the scientific viewpoint, as I said, is based on a number of unexamined, for the most part, beliefs on which it builds its structure. For instance, that you can understand the whole of nature without understanding the nature of human mind. You can just pretend that the human mind doesn't have any part to play in the universe. You can understand the way things are independently of that, for instance. But Buddha Dhamma is clear about the necessity of faith, of reasoned faith, which humbly acknowledges itself as faith, doesn't delude itself to be anything more than faith. And Buddha cautioned us about saying, this is true because I believe it. And because I believe it so strongly, it must be true. Buddha says we protect the truth by saying, I haven't actually realized this for myself as yet, but this is my faith, this is my confidence. And my faith and my confidence is based on this, this, and this. Now the faith that the Buddha stressed as being absolutely indispensable is first of all faith in the Buddha's enlightenment. To believe that the Buddha was truly enlightened. In other words, there is such a thing as enlightenment. Buddha realized it. And there are certain ramifications of that, or certain very important beliefs or faiths that derive from that. In Theravada school, we give great importance to the fact that the Buddha was a human being. He was born, if somewhat miraculously, and his body got old, sick, died. He was seriously ill before he died, had dysentery prior to that. Sometimes he got a backache. And just to sit leaning up against the wall, or in the last years of his life, sometimes the weary and asked other monks to carry on giving the Dhamma talk so he could have a rest. Venerable Nanda saw him one day taking the sun and was struck by how the Buddha's golden skin, which was been so beautiful, was now wrinkled and old. And the Buddha was affectionate in scolding and said, well, how could it be any other way? That's what happens to skin, that's what happens to bodies. It's the way bodies are, the way skin is. So the Buddha was a human being. Of course, we could say a very special human being. But his attainment of enlightenment is, I feel, all the more inspiring because It was the enlightenment of a human being. And because it was the enlightenment of a human being, it means that enlightenment is possible. It's a proof. The Buddha proved the existence of enlightenment, proved the potential of human beings for enlightenment. For that we owe him inestimable debt of gratitude. So the Buddha realized enlightenment. He proved that enlightenment exists through his own experience, and realizing enlightenment as a human being, he proved that this is the potential of human beings and therefore our potential. So the principle, most important principle to be derived from our faith in Buddha's enlightenment is faith in our own capacity for enlightenment. And it's this faith in our capacity for enlightenment which must gradually cleanse our belief in our fundamental sin, our fundamental ineptitude, our fundamental badness, which is like a virus that infects so many human beings. I think I've mentioned before being very impressed by the King of Thailand's reply to a BBC interviewer. He said, "You're a Buddhist, Your Majesty. Do you believe in original sin?" And the King said straight away, "No, I believe in original purity." In meditation practice, in development of mindfulness, we are learning to put down our identification with the physical body, with feelings, with perceptions, with thoughts, with ideas, with sense consciousness, moment by moment. So the practical realization, moment by moment, of the enlightened mind. Even at very early stages of meditation, we can get just a glimpse of what that means. And we can certainly see that when our mind is caught up with attachment, with desire, with greed, hatred, jealousy, confusion, fear, paranoia, that the mind is in a very painful, contracted state. When the mind is clearer, calmer, thoughts, feelings, and so on arise and reach out like hooks reaching out for a ringlet, something to grasp onto. It's like the mind with mindfulness is completely smooth. There's nothing for these thoughts to cling to, attach to. The mind with sati is Teflon coated. Nothing can stick to it. And the thoughts arise, they slip off, they slip away. There's no footing for them, there's nowhere for them to stay. And it's very easy to see. It's not a great insight, it's not a profound spiritual experience to see that a mind that is bright, clear, present, in the present, is inherently pleasant, happy, And the mind which is deluded by experience into identifying with it, grasping onto it, seeking something from experience, is basically inherently unhappy. So we have a choice. In other words, it's easier to grasp onto things and be deluded than it is to let go of things and be undeluded. That's why there are so few arahants in the world and so many deluded people. This is our faith, because the Buddha and all the great teachers over the past 2,500 years ago approved that it can be done. Ajahn Chah, I used to make a comparison with groundwater. He said people who are too lazy to dig down into the earth start to feel thirsty and suffer, but insist that there, these days, there's no water below the surface. Now, those days are gone. But anyone who is willing to do the work of digging down, if they dig with diligence and constancy and sincerity, they will reach the water below the surface, because that water is there, it's always there. The Buddha said whether a Buddha is born into the world or not, all conditioned things are impermanent, stable, suffering, not self. So the Buddha Sasana arises and passes away. It may last 2,000 years, 5,000 years, 10,000 years. But the truths on which Buddha Sasana is founded do not change. They're timeless. And the capacity of human beings to realize those truths is also timeless. So we have, from the culture, from the religion, from our background, whatever, most of us have a tendency to give more weight, give more importance to the negative than to the positive. We have taught ourselves to consider the negative to be more real than the positive. If you have a positive mental state, or a kind, compassionate mental state, decide to do something for others, to the goodness of your heart, and then during your efforts to help others, to relieve their pain, or whatever, just a single stray thought of desire for praise or desire for some kind of reward just pops up in your mind. Immediately, tendency is to pounce on that as proof that behind all this facade of goodness and kindness, there's the real me. So on what grounds do we consider one passing stray self-aggrandizing thought, or mean, nasty little mental reflex, as being more real, more intrinsic to who we really are, than all the beautiful mental states that preceded it and succeeded it? That was a rhetorical question which I'll answer as none at all. It's just a habit. It's just a habit you've got into. It's just a mild form, or not such a mild form, mental illness. And you can stop doing it when you see it's just a habit. So you can get out of it just like stopping smoking cigarettes. It's a simple practice of mindfulness. This is a wholesome mental state. This is an unwholesome mental state. Not drawing conclusions. Not drawing conclusions from I have a wholesome mental state rising, therefore I'm wonderful. Or I have an unwholesome mental state arising in my mind, therefore I'm a bad person. This idea that we're a certain kind of person, this is me, this is who I am, this is the conceit which underlies so much of our suffering. We're not capable yet, or we don't see the value yet of being able to live with ambiguity. We don't know who we are. We don't even know whether that idea of being anybody is even a valid way of articulating things anyway. There's this, moment by moment. What's this? It's this. It's experience, the stuff of experience, the process of experience. The Buddha said, look however much you want, you won't find this permanent, self-existent entity. That's who you are. The idea that there is a permanent self-existent entity in here is the basic cause of dukkha, suffering. And the idea that there's this basic underlying entity, me, is inherently bad, is most unwise and deluded kind of conceit. So the Buddha is saying, not wagging his finger at us and saying, just don't do that. He's saying, look, inquire, educate yourself about yourself. Does this feeling that you're carrying around with you bear up under the light of investigation? Look clearly. Look clearly at your experience without trying to push it into categories, without needing some fixed answer or description. But being with the truth of things moment by moment. You see, you don't need that kind of firm definition. I feel that the more you devote yourself to that kind of sincere inquiry, the less that idea of yourself being fundamentally bad or inadequate stands up. It's a convention. It's a convention which you've believed in. It's a superstition. It's not just a belief, it's a superstitious belief. It's a superstitious belief that can only survive as long as you're afraid to push it, to test it.
It's a paper tiger. So in monastic life, we have a great deal of form, rules, regulations. Those are all there to free you for the investigation. They're not there to detract from it. They're not there to have any intrinsic value in themselves. But they're creating a form and a vessel which you can most effectively do this work of investigation, inquiry. You're not forced to believe anything. If you have a belief that doesn't fit, doesn't agree with my belief, or the beliefs in the views that are listed as right view, you're not going to get kicked out. You're asked to inquire, to look, to penetrate. This is an education that we're about. It's a lifetime education. Education of our conduct. Education of our relationship with the physical world. Education of our relationship with the social world, with the people around us. Education of the mind, of the emotions. Education of the wisdom faculty. Samadhi means non-distraction. This is a classic definition in the commentaries. So the way of mental development is one where you're inclining the mind towards non-distraction and inclining the mind away from, withdrawing from that which distracts and leads the mind to this diffuse, scattered kind of state. Focusing the mind in the present. If the mind is caught up with lusting after experiences, the memory of experiences, the anticipation of experiences, or the idea of experiences, caught up with ideas and concepts and plans, this is not the way to clarity of mind. This is not a path of refining the quality of distraction. It's not moving from coarse distraction to subtle distraction, but it's sloughing off that whole dead skin of thoughts and memories and anticipations. And do you dare to do it? Sajjan Shah says, you need that courage. Make the jump. You know, take those as a refuge. You know, certain kinds of thoughts, certain memories, certain mental states that are comfortable. It's like an old coat or some kind of item of clothing that you're really fond of. You know, an old pair of shoes or an old coat or something. You know, you put it on and you just feel comfortable. And there are mental states, there are ideas, there are trains of thought that are like our old coats or old shoes. So it's just a sense of comfort and familiarity about them, which we retreat to when we feel threatened or uncertain. And the way of practice is to relinquish that. This is what's called leaving the home life. The home life means all those old items of clothing, all those old bits of furniture that you can just sink into and feel at home, relaxed. Don't have to think anymore. Don't have to be present anymore. And giving that up, relinquishing that, going forth. This is the image of the monastic. It's not someone who's enclosing themselves in a kind of a in this cloistered space surrounded by high walls. The image of the Buddhist monastic is, or the Buddhist is the one who goes forth. So he's going forth to new frontiers, always pushing onwards, pushing onwards. Never content with the wholesome states that one has acquired so far. It's a questing mind. Not allowing the mind just to get hot and bothered and mean and twisted by anger and irritation and pettiness. It's a sad thing that our mind will even take refuge in mental states that we know at the time that this is just a pathetic kind of dwelling. But the force of habit is very strong. But we demean ourselves through allowing that kind of indulgence in the heat of anger, the self-righteousness, this childish, immature kind of, I don't want this, I don't like this, leave me alone, go away. So we have to be willing to put that aside as well. And intensely just don't want to shut down. Not be bothered. Go to sleep. Turn off, switch off. The refuge of dullness. The refuge of activity. And you see people who, perhaps in a period of grief, or other people just naturally just can't sit still for 5 minutes. You could be doing something all the time. If I'm not doing something, then maybe I don't exist. Yeah, I do, therefore I am. That's another sad refuge that people take. Exist on, you see. You don't stop existing just because you're not doing anything. It's not true. This is why Thailand's such a wonderful place. And people, you see the villages, not so much these days perhaps, but in the old days, I remember just being so impressed by young novices who could just do nothing and just not feel guilty about it. You know, it's just taking laziness to an art form. I felt like a mere beginner, rather sort of clumsy, lazy person compared to the novices and the monks I saw. Now, when I was first here, of course, like with most people, I just struggled with the heat and the humidity. And when there was a rain burst, you know, suddenly the skies open, the rain come down, and just feel full of energy, and it just felt so great. You know, I just want to go and sit and meditate and come out for the chores in the afternoon, and all the monks and novices just, had a really good sleep today. And I realized that the sannyā was completely different. For my friends and companions, rain meant sleep. And rain meant just laying there and listening to the sound of the raindrops on the tin roof. And it was enjoyable. Now, I'm not saying that they were right or that they were on the way to Nibbana by any means, but for someone like myself, or for most of us who felt I had to make use of every single moment of the day, I used to have make out a schedule for myself. I've got to do at least 6 hours, preferably 8 hours of formal practice every day, otherwise I'm bad. Otherwise I'm not earning the alms of the lay people. I'm cheating them. I'm not living up to my side of the bargain. And to go to a sākhā where these people are just quite happy to, after the meal, and maybe just do a clear up, just do a perfunctory, half an hour on the jhokrum path, and then, the really enjoyable part of the day was have a lay down. And it shocked me. But it was good for me, because I realized just how, my attitude wasn't the middle way either. There was this kind of driven nature to it. I've got to. And so, and then just to be able to see that, I've got to. I said, well, what have I done? Yeah, they don't. So just letting go of that, I've got to, and then I found that, it wasn't that I started crashing out for hours whenever it started raining, but, I just enjoyed my life more. So this is what I'm planning to do this for the rest of my life. I think I just ought to try and enjoy it a bit more. Just not enjoy it by not doing anything. But not feeling that I have to do something. And the more I meditated, and I would suggest that this is surely a common experience. The more that you meditate, whenever your mind is free of the thoughts and confusion and so on, there's just a sense of rightness and balance. And goodness. It's the moment you just open the mind up and just go down through the impure layers, and you just go deeper. You come to something very good, don't you? Is it not everyone's experience here that the moment your mind becomes a little bit peaceful, even a little bit peaceful, it's immediately more happy? And when it's not peaceful. Peacefulness and happiness are identical. And so if you're not creating suffering for yourself by attaching to things and wanting things to be in a certain way and fearing that they won't be the way you want them to be, and just basically tussling and struggling with existence, but when you're able to put things down and be present and clear in the present moment, it's all right. It's quite nice, actually. It's more than that. It's extremely pleasant. And that's accessible to all, every one of us. And the more you practice, the more profound it becomes. And the more firm and the more of a refuge that it becomes. And things that you really thought, yeah, this is who I am, I'm just good job, well, there's nobody else can hear what I'm thinking. No, they'd hate me. Just think if you had a kind of a loudspeaker on your head, and every time you thought something, it would be broadcast out. Horrible nightmare. Nobody'd ever want to talk to me again. So what? It's just noise. It's not who you are. It's not any different. Probably all of us. I mean, all the thoughts and all the nastiness and the greedy thoughts, the hate-filled thoughts, the petty kind of thoughts. Basically, it's just the same stuff. Stuff and greedy thoughts in my head are probably not very different from greedy thoughts in your head or anybody's. It's just greedy thoughts, angry thoughts, fearful thoughts, irritable thoughts. I mean, it's just like illnesses. If you say, I've got diabetes, you've got diabetes, he's got diabetes, the symptoms are going to be pretty much the same. I've got cancer, you've got cancer. I mean, these are just illnesses. They're just impersonal phenomena that arise in the minds of human beings. Just that. There's nothing, there's nothing special or unique. You don't have to be unique. Just about this Buddha knowing, being awake, moment by moment, letting go, and see where that takes you. So, I'd like to offer these thoughts to you this evening.